question of stages, as opposed to the permanent revolution. Where does this idea come from that you have to have stages, whereas first you have a democratic revolution, then you have a long period of capitalist development, and only many years later, sometimes it's envisaged as decades. Mao in 1948 considered 100 years the gap between the first and the second stage is necessary. And then eventually you have the socialist revolution. Well, it's a mechanical application of a basic Marxist idea. If you look at discussions on historical materialism, the development of society through different economic systems, you have the old classic from slavery to feudalism, from feudalism to capitalism, from capitalism to socialism. And only when once these systems have developed to a degree and then entered crisis do you have the next stage. And on that basis, the idea is that before you can have socialism, you need develop capitalism and therefore develop working class. And that therefore capitalism is progressive because it develops the means of production. And it has a period in which it develops the means of production. Now, that isn't wrong as a basic, simple idea about how things develop, let's say, in Britain or France or Holland or several other advanced capitalist countries. But what the Stalinists did and the Mensheviks did before them is to take this idea, apply it to an underdeveloped country like Russia, and say a democratic stage is necessary. It's a very backward economy. It's feudal or semi-feudal. What we need here is a bourgeois revolution, which happened in France, which happened in Britain. We need to have the Russian bourgeois revolution, or the Chinese bourgeois revolution, or whatever, or the Indonesian bourgeois revolution. Therefore, on that basis, the proletariat should support the bourgeoisie in carrying out the bourgeois revolution. That's the simple version of it. And it goes back to Marx and his approach, let's say, to the German Revolution in the 1840s and later, i.e. the German bourgeoisie wasn't in power yet. There was a working class. The next stage would be bourgeois, and the working class would therefore be the most revolutionary wing of that revolution, but it would still be the working class supporting the bourgeoisie in carrying out the democratic bourgeois revolution. And this explains this idea of the two stages, separated in time by a very long period. Having this outlook in a single country, it's only possible if you look at each country in isolation, and if you try to, say, impose on Russia in the early 20th century what happened in Britain, and you say, well, Russian economy is more or less at the level of the British economy 300 years ago, something like that, and say, therefore, what we need is to go through the same period and phases that the British economy has gone through, whereby we'll then have an advanced modern industry with the proletariat, and that proletariat will be able to then lead the socialist revolution. Now, that is possible if you have a mechanical approach and isolate each country from the world situation. The problem is, the world economy is not made up of single individual countries isolated from each other, inside the borders of which everything can develop in a mechanical way, the same as it happened in other countries. They are part. They're part of a whole. They're part of a world economy. Now, in classical countries of capitalism like Holland, England, France, and some others, we saw the development of the bourgeoisie as a class under feudalism, developing in the cities, the merchant class, the producers, etc., gradually becoming a new force within society. And at a certain point, feudalism was an obstacle to the further development of that class. The capitalist class doesn't require serfs that are tied to the land. It requires free labourers who can flow into the cities and can be employed for a wage. They need wage labour, not bonded labour to the land. The system of the feudal aristocracy was an impediment at a certain point to the further development, and this led to conflicts. It explains Cromwell in England and the struggle between the upcoming bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. It explains the French Revolution, which was the bourgeoisie removing the aristocracy and the fetters of the feudalism. That's how it developed in a few key countries, the first capitalist countries. But this very development of these countries, and this shows you the difference between a mechanical approach and an all-round Marxist approach, the development of these countries into advanced capitalist countries changed the conditions for all the other countries after that. Because whereas England or France, well, England, especially in Holland, when they emerged as capitalist countries, they didn't come on the world scene, there were no powerful capitalist countries dominating. They were the first ones. That explains why Britain became such a powerful imperialist country and dominated half the world economically and militarily, because it developed industry in a big way before anybody else, and that gave it a huge advantage. Imperialism develops out of the first few advanced capitalist countries, and that means that they dominate the rest of the world. Just to make a very simple picture of the thing. Let's say you have a small producer of shoes in England in the 1600s, producing shoes which, probably mostly by hand, productivity was quite low, but it was the most advanced way of producing shoes. They had no major competitors, and they could produce for England and for a world market. You take a producer of shoes, let's say, 200 years later, in India, an Indian shoemaker, producing shoes more or less the same as the English one would have done 200 years earlier. Now, is he going to be able to become the major shoe producer like they did in England, where from small production they became major factories making shoes with machines, and therefore massively increasing productivity and lowering the costs of their goods? Well, the Indian shoemaker has a little problem. He's not emerging onto a world market which is open, let's say, to the new industry. He's emerging onto a world market which is already dominated by advanced industry of the imperialist countries. Therefore, there's not much chance of him developing over time into a massive Indian shoemaker with factories and etc. He's competing with a low level of productivity, primitive instruments of production, compared to these advanced producers in the imperialist countries. That is a simplistic, little simple example, but it gives you an idea that the classical capitalist development for these people in India or China or whatever is not there, it's not present, and it's not possible, because they are dominated by a far more productive and advanced economy, such as the British, the American, later on the Japanese and others. Imperialism also went through a phase of taking over practically the rest of the world and colonizing it, getting control of the raw materials and also exploiting the labor there. So you can see that the problem is different in a country like Russia at the beginning of the 20th century to what it was in England in the 1640s. However, having said that, there's another contradiction in the situation, is that although they were backward countries and the road to modern capitalist development was close to them because of the domination of imperialism, that didn't mean that you didn't have development of elements of capitalism within these countries. For instance, in Russia, you had massive foreign investment, which is the capitalists of France, of Britain and other countries, building factories from nothing in Russia to exploit the cheap labour. So they transplanted into the heart of what is still a fundamentally backward feudal economy, islands of extremely advanced capitalism. You didn't have the small shops, the small producers that you had in Britain gradually building up and accumulating capital and becoming bigger and bigger. You had the transplanting of a factory of 1,000 or 2,000 workers, completely modern industry with machinery and a proletariat concentrated in these factories, within what was still a fundamentally backward economy. Added to that, you had the investment of the landlords of Russia, who were, the money they were making from the land, they started to invest it in these industries. So there was a linking up of the ruling elite in Russia, which was still fundamentally feudal landlords, and the foreign capitalist class. This meant that you had the development of a modern proletariat in the heart of an immensely backward country. Now, that changes the conditions that we're looking at. We're not looking at Cromwell, who could mobilize the poorer layers of society, an incipient proletariat, let's say, that still hadn't developed like the one we know today, and he could lean on it with no danger of these workers saying, well, there's 10 million of us, and we have a union here, and we have a party, and our policy is socialism, and yeah, you can use our support, but we're going to clean you out as soon as we get to power. They weren't there. There wasn't such a modern working class. It was still in its early stages. In Russia, that is one of the contradictions that emerges, is you do have this modern proletariat within this backward economy, with trade unions, and even with socialist, a Marxist party, the Social Democratic Labour Party, led by Lenin. Extremely advanced thinking, if you look at the context. Now, in 1904, Trotsky wrote Results and Prospects, which is where he develops his ideas on the permanent revolution, and he explains that the classical approach is no longer possible in Russia. You cannot, you can't simply say, well, Russia is a backward economy, therefore the next step is the bourgeois revolution, and then a long period of capitalist development. All the socialists in Russia agreed that the forthcoming revolution would be bourgeois, of course. Even Lenin accepted that, because the tasks of the bourgeois revolution hadn't been carried out in Russia. And therefore, that was an unaccomplished task. The problem was, what would be the nature of the revolution once it began on that road? Now, the bourgeoisie of Russia had become reactionary even before coming to power. And the reason for that was precisely this development of the proletariat on the one hand. And on the other, sometimes it was literally the same person who was investing in the industries that were being brought in from outside was a landlord. So one of the tasks of the bourgeois democratic revolution is the agrarian question. Break down the power of the land aristocracy. Now, that meant that these people, although they had interests in the factories and industry, they were also owners of the land. That meant going against themselves. Furthermore, any attempt to mobilize the masses in the conditions of Russia, you had this modern proletariat breathing down your neck as soon as you moved, with an agenda which would go beyond the interests of the capitalists. So they became de facto reactionary. They became an obstacle to their own revolution. And Lenin understood that this was the nature of the bourgeoisie, and therefore the tasks fell to the proletariat. But when in the polemics, the Stalinists who try and portray Trotsky as having invented the whole thing about permanent revolution. They even the Trotskyists, they just want to be carrying out revolutions all the time, permanently. You know, every day, every year, every decade. That's what they're about. Completely misconstruing the meaning of the word permanent. In Marxist language, we also have to be careful of actually understanding what a term means, in the same way that, you know, materialism for us in a philosophical sense doesn't mean what it means to your average person in the street. The average person in the street, when they see materialists, they think of people who want a Rolls Royce and a fur coat and a mansion and a swimming pool. That's materialism. Idealism are the ones who want to change society. For Marxists, it's actually the other way around. Materialism for us means that we base ourselves on the real material world and not some abstraction. And again, with the word permanent revolution, it refers to the process of the revolution, as we will see. But in the manifesto, right at the end of the manifesto, talking about Germany, and this was in 1848, 47, 48, when they wrote this, he says that he actually makes the point. He talks about the German revolution. He says that, I'm doing it from the Italian because I couldn't find my English edition. He says Germany is on the eve of its bourgeois revolution, and therefore communists pay particular attention to this question, and because it's carrying out its revolution in conditions of general European civilization which is more advanced, and with a proletariat which is more developed than what England had in the 17th century and France in the 18th century, he refers specifically to this point. Therefore, the bourgeois, the German bourgeois revolution, can only be an immediate prelude to a proletarian revolution. Here, in essence, we have the permanent revolution, which Trotsky was referring to. Trotsky didn't invent things; he applied Marxism to the real conditions that existed, and based himself on a tradition which Marx already had developed. Marx also, in other writings, referred to the German bourgeoisie as being reactionary before it had even come to power. And that posed the problem, obviously, to the tactics of the communists in the revolution. Now, Lenin had moved on and had understood the reactionary nature of the bourgeoisie in Russia. And he developed the idea of the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry. Already within that, you see no role for the bourgeoisie, in the sense that the bourgeoisie had become reactionary. He took into account the weakness of the bourgeoisie and its reactionary nature, and the role of the working class as an important class in the process. The weakness of this position of Lenin, which Lenin later on actually admitted in the April Theses, he says it very clearly, that it was a formula which it was basically like an algebraic formula which left certain things open. What Trotsky highlighted was that the weakness of the theory was it gave a kind of equal role to the proletariat and peasantry. And Trotsky explained that throughout history, the peasantry, the petty bourgeoisie, has never played an independent role. It has always supported one or other of the major classes in the cities, like it supported the bourgeoisie in the French Revolution. And Trotsky did not, and this is another falsification, he did not deny the role of the peasantry, which the Stalinists had done all kinds of distortions of Trotsky. After the revolution, they said that he denied the possibility of a socialist revolution, whereas actually in 1904, it was the other way around. Trotsky was saying that the bourgeois revolution in Russia will tend to grow over into the socialist revolution in one permanent process rather than through stages. It was the Stalinists and all the others who back in 1904, 1905 denied this possibility. The old Bolsheviks were stuck to this idea of the democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry. Trotsky said, yes, an alliance between the proletariat and the peasantry, but the proletariat will play the leading role in the revolution. That was his point. I'll quote that from Marx. Now, we have the experience of the Russian Revolution itself, which actually brilliantly confirmed what Trotsky had predicted. What happened in Russia in 1917? Was there a bourgeois democratic revolution? Was there the dictatorship of the proletariat and peasantry? And then decades of capitalist development? That's not what happened. Historical facts are that within a few months, you had the bourgeois and the socialist revolution were compounded into one continuous process, and the workers ended up taking power in October 1917. Now, the April Thesis is a key document, I think, in discussing this question, because it actually caused a hell of a polemic and turmoil inside the Bolsheviks, because up until Lenin came back in April 1917, the Bolshevik leaders in Russia, including Stalin, had been acting on the old formula: democratic dictatorship of proletariat and peasantry. The revolution is going to be a bourgeois one, and they were looking for the progressive bourgeoisie with which to have an alliance, and they were tending towards support for the provisional government, which they saw as the embodiment of bourgeois power, and therefore the bourgeois democratic revolution that's being carried out. But Lenin comes back and shakes everything up, because he understands the real situation that has developed, and he pushes for a radical change in the policy of the party. Now, point two, on page six, right at the beginning of the April thesis, he says, already he says, the specific feature of the present situation in Russia is that the country is passing from the first stage of revolution, he says, which, owing to the insufficient class consciousness and organisation of the proletariat, placed power in the hands of the bourgeoisie, to its second stage, which must place power in the hands of the proletariat and the poorest sections of the peasants. Now that is a very clear position on the part of Lenin. Now there are groups internationally who have tried to construe into this the stages theory, because Lenin speaks about stages. But what they ignore is that what Lenin sees as a stage is not a necessary objective stage, i.e. decades of capitalist development. He says that it's owing to the insufficient class consciousness and organisation of the proletariat. That is why power has ended up in the hands of the bourgeoisie. He doesn't say the proletariat cannot take power and must not take power, as some groups and the Stalinists and the Mensheviks said. He said it's the insufficient class consciousness and organisation. In other parts of the text, Lenin emphasises, because of this, our task is to patiently explain and basically make the working class conscious of its own force and power in order to take power and lead it to the taking of power. He says, he talks about the recognition of the fact that in most of the Soviets and workers' deputies, our party is in a minority. So far, a small minority, as against a block of all the petty bourgeois opportunist elements, from the popular socialists and the socialist revolutionaries, etc., etc. He says, as long as we are in a minority, we carry on the work of criticising and exposing errors, and at the same time we preach the necessity of transferring the entire state power to the Soviets of workers' deputies so that the people may overcome their mistakes by experience. And then he goes on about the demands of the April thesis, you know, abolition of the police, the army, the bureaucracy. He's not talking about a bourgeois revolution. He's not talking about a bourgeois democratic revolution. He's talking about workers taking power. It's absolutely crystal clear what Lenin is referring to in the April thesis. Later on, he says, quoting Marx, our theory is not a dogma, but a guide to action. And he says, Marx and Engels always said, rightly ridiculing the mere memorizing and repetition of formulas, in inverted commas, that at best are capable only of marking out general tasks, which are necessarily modifiable by the concrete economic and political conditions of each particular period of the historical process. And he says this repeatedly. You've got to take account of the real concrete conditions, the changes that are taking place, the new balance of forces. He criticises also the old Bolsheviks constantly. He says, the Bolshevik slogans and ideas on the whole have been confirmed by history, but concretely things have worked out differently. They are more original, more peculiar, more variegated than anyone could have expected. Of course, Trotsky did actually foresee it, and it's not by chance that they came together. He says, to ignore or overlook this fact would mean taking after those old Bolsheviks, which he puts in inverted commas, which he's actually ridiculing, who more than once already have played so regrettable a role in the history of our party by reiterating formulas senselessly learned by rote instead of studying the specific features of the new and living reality. And he refers to the revolutionary democratic dictatorship of the proletariat and the peasantry, and he says, this formula is already antiquated. Events have moved it from the realm of formulas into the realm of reality, clothed it with flesh and bone, concretized it, and thereby modified it.